Hello and welcome to the Android Central podcast. My name is Daniel Bader. This week on the show, I've brought in two suckers that have willfully installed iOS 14 on their iPhones, and we are going to dissect just exactly what Apple stole from Google's Android operating system. And then later on, we will talk all about the OnePlus Nord, the artist formerly known as the OnePlus Z, and we will dissect a bunch of new exclusive leaks that Android Central has been privy to. So joining me on the show, Joe Maring, how are you?
Hello.
Welcome back.
I'm doing well. It's always a good time to be on here and especially talk about some iOS goodie stuff.
Yeah, it is a little bit, it's a little on the nose, and we're recording this on Friday, so it's already been, 5 days since the announcement. That's just the way that our podcast recording schedule works, but, everybody has already heard about this, but I'm sure we'll be able to glean a couple of unique things. And to round out the conversation, Harish Jonalagada,
yeah,
all the way from India, with all of the exclusives. How are you?
I'm doing good. Good to be back.
We are, we're 5 days out of the WWDC keynote. It was Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern. This was a different kind of show. Obviously, it was remote for the first time. It was pre-recorded. It zoomed by, I would say. It is extreme. It was just an extremely fast. It's, given the amount of information, right? Like the number of announcements that happened in this, 2 hour keynote just was insane, and there was just a lot to cover. So they started with iOS 14. I think for our purposes, it's probably the most important topic to discuss. Although there's the transition from Intel to Apple Silicon, which we'll talk about in a minute, but just, first impressions here, Joe, you rounded up 8 things that Apple, politely stole or copied from Android. Everybody likes to play this up. Obviously, Apple did not steal them wholesale from Android. Android has also done its fair share of co-opting iOS and Apple, Apple's ideas over the years. But talk us through what it's been like over the last 5 days using iOS 14 and whether it is actually in practice similar to using an Android phone today.
Yeah, there was honestly kind of a weird learning curve having like an app drawer and widgets, just because whenever I've used my iPhone for the past couple of years, I've gotten in the mindset where you just have your app pages and there's no organization. And then having that option all of a sudden is kind of throwing a wrench in the whole system at first. But when you first download iOS 14, at least this is the way it is with the developer beta, it looks just like it does with iOS 13, where it's just your endless pages of apps. But if you go into the, I guess it's officially called jiggle mode, where you can edit the homepage, you now have the option to hide as many of these pages as you want to. And the way Craig Federighi kind of alluded to the way they've seen people use this is where you have like your first two home pages or so that are organized and you know where everything is at, but then you kind of have your overflow pages of 3, 4, 5 or whatever, where it's just kind of the dumping ground for everything else. So if you go into the jiggle or edit mode and you hide those pages, you can shrink it down to one home page, two home screens, whatever you want it to be. And then once you do that, to the furthest right of your page, so if you go to the last home screen and you swipe over again, the app library is iOS's version of the app drawer that we have in Android. This is probably my biggest issue I have with the way that Apple's implemented the Androidification of the operating system, because as we've seen, it's pre-made groups of like app folders. So instead of just an alphabetical list of everything that's installed on your phone, you have these folders for things like social apps, productivity, utilities, entertainment. And some of these you can just tap right on the icon and launch directly into it. But if you tap on the bundle icon there, it expands the whole folder. And I think the idea here was to make it feel a little bit more organized, not so chaotic of just seeing endless icons for everything that's installed. But it almost, I may, and it could just be as someone that's used Android for years and years, it feels like I don't quite know where everything is at the same way that I do on a Pixel 4. There's a suggestions folder that tries to give you recommended apps the way that the top row on the Pixel phones do. And that seems to be pretty accurate with surfacing apps that it thinks I want to use. It's just weird, though. I don't know. Harish, I think you've played with it a little bit, too. Have you found this intuitive at all, or is it kind of thrown you for a loop on, you know, whether this is a good implementation or not?
I totally agree with you that there is a learning curve here, because it's just weird to have the ability to switch off these pages after so many years of just having all these apps just live on the home screen like that. So that was weird, but it was a good move. I think they could have done more in terms of just organizing that app library better. I do agree that it looks very cluttered, and I do not like those preset customizations, those preset categories. I would like to choose them myself. So I think that this is just the first iteration and something that they will eventually get right. But I am glad that they actually have this feature now, because for the longest time, a lot of the Chinese manufacturers choose to emulate iOS, and they also ditched the app drawer. So now that it's there, I'm looking forward to using it on my Xiaomi phone.
Oh my God. That's a really interesting. Okay. That is a completely separate topic that I need to dig into, because holy cow, iOS copying on, like, just, you know, ColorOS used to be an iOS clone. It's no longer, but MIUI is still largely, and to some extent, so is, EMUI. Getting rid of the app drawer on Android phones was just a pernicious move. Like, it just was not user it was not user friendly at all, just given the fact that Android was built around the idea of an app drawer. User behavior was sort of influenced to understand that there was a differentiation between the home screen and the app drawer. Anyway, we'll get to that in a minute. But I do want to point out that, you know, first of all, Apple and Google have been moving in the direction of suggesting the apps and the services that you're going to need throughout the day for many years, right? On-device machine learning will allow you on Android 11, for instance, to have a row of four apps that, you know, the Pixel launcher will suggest to you over the course of the day, and that changes depending on what it thinks you're going to need. I've been using it on the Android 11 beta for a while now, and the first few days it was useless because it had no data, right? It didn't know what I was going to use at different times. Now it knows. I use my clock app for my coffee timer every morning. I turn on my phone and it knows at, you know, 7:30 the clock app is sitting in that dock every morning now. It just knows, and that's super useful. iOS, for a long time, you would create a folder, you would combine two app icons, it would suggest the name of the folder, and a lot of the times it was right, but many times it wasn't. With the app library, it seems like Apple has taken this one step further and is imposing these categories on you that you can't change. And it's making an assumption about your usage that I don't think it has. It's had a lot of success within the past. The fact that you can't change those categories, to me, at least right now, seems like an oversight.
Yeah, I don't necessarily mind the idea of having things grouped by category, just because it can be helpful to know, you know, like, these are my messaging apps, these are my, you know, food delivery apps. But the way it's structured, like, you can't put, you know, utilities above productivity, or you can't put your creativity apps above your social ones. If there is just some level of customization there where you could tweak, like, what folders were shown or how the folders were organized, I think that would go a great distance in making this a lot more user-friendly. But again, this is just the app library or the app drawer on its own is such a big shift for iOS that I think Apple probably has the mentality of let's just get this out there, not add in too many customization options and let people get used to it. And then I'd be really surprised if in iOS 15, iOS 16, we don't see the options to, you know, further customize this once people get familiar with how it works on its core at first.
Yeah, that is a good point, because this is essentially a paradigm shift for how apps work on iOS. I mean, how apps are displayed on iOS. So yeah, it's a big change.
Yeah, and it's interesting with the suggested apps, because for the longest time, you've had this Siri suggestions on iOS where you can swipe down from your home screen and it gives you 8 populated apps that you can open right away. And I have found myself still using that because, at least for my use case, it's still faster just to swipe down, tap the app I want to use, which is generally pretty accurate as opposed to swiping over a couple pages to the app drawer, trying to find it in the specific folder. And it seems, at least right now, it's a lot more searching and digging than swiping down, tapping a Siri suggestion, or swiping down and just searching the spotlight like you've been able to do for a while.
Right. So Siri suggestions was added iOS 11, I want to say. I can't remember the specific edition. And it does seem to work fairly reliably, as you said. But I've always found that just maintaining my iOS app library has been a chore. I don't always put my apps in folders. And over the course of time, the folders that I have don't get maintained. I have a million games on my iPhone and I forget that I have them because it's just not intuitive to look through those folders, especially when there are 8 or 9 pages. Does App Library solve that for you, Joe, at least so far? Like, do you feel like if there are a couple of tweaks to it, discovery of existing apps is going to be fixed on iOS, especially if you have like 100 apps like many of us do?
Oh, yeah. Like, even with the complaints I have with it not being perfect, it is far and away better than just having no dedicated place to organize them. On iOS 13, I had like my 2 pages that were kind of organized, but it was mostly just a lot of folders and a lot of standalone app icons, with pages 3 and 4 just being overflow for the stuff I really don't use and not organized in any real way. But now I can just have like my first page be the apps I use pretty much every single day, a second page where it's apps I use a little bit less frequently, but I still want to have that muscle memory of knowing where I can access them on the page. And then everything else is just dumped in the app library. And now, instead of having just app icons, widgets in iOS 14, I absolutely love. I tend not to use widgets a whole lot on Android other than the traditional Google Calendar widget and the at-a-glance widget that is built in on Pixel phones. But there's something about the way Apple has implemented them, and I'm positive it's just because of the walled garden, the closed ecosystem, where all of them feel like they are meant to be together. And I know a lot of that probably has to do with the only widgets being available being ones from Apple, given how early on in iOS 14 that we are.
Right.
I can put like a calendar widget, a reminders widget, the fitness widget, a weather widget, anywhere next to each other or anywhere on the home screen, and they all feel like they're part of, you know, like the same design, or they all should exist together rather than some Android widgets looking kind of terrible depending on who developed it and how much thought was put into it. And we touched on that in one of our editorials that, you know, this could be a wake-up call for developers that if you're going to put this time and attention to your iOS widgets, it's probably going to be worth it to give that same attention to Android widgets, which kind of seem to be an afterthought these days. And I also really appreciate how Apple kind of took that idea and they, you know, took a long time to add such a fundamental thing, but they built upon it with like the Smart Stack widget, which can automatically surface different widgets in the same area depending on the time of day and what it thinks you're going to want to use. And the fact that you can even make your own by just dragging, you know, one widget on top of the other, and you get the option to manually cycle through it or turn that into the Smart Stack idea as well. So it took a long time, similar to the app drawer, but I have a great appreciation and I'm really enjoying the way they've been implemented, the thought that's gone into them, and assuming third-party app developers kind of follow the same guidelines and the same design language, I think it's going to be really interesting a year down the road to see, you know, how that library expands as we go on.
So I want to bring it back to Android a little bit, Harish, because on Android, you do have this duality of static widgets versus dynamic widgets. Some widgets you can resize in real time. You can also scroll through them. I'm thinking of calendar, to-do apps, things like that. I mean, widgets are and were for a long time mini apps. And as a result, the constraints put on them have been much less than what it looks like iOS widgets have, at least the ones that are on the home screen. I was listening to a WWDC developer podcast a few days ago, and they detailed the limitations for these iOS widgets. They have to be built in Swift UI. They can't be dynamic. So there's no scrolling. You can't have like a calculator as a widget. It has to be a static, relatively static image or kind of like cycling set of images, and tapping on the widget can only deep link into an app. So you can't tap on the widget to perform an action just on the home screen. And this is obviously to conserve battery life. If it's something that's going to be in front of you while you're on the home screen, it can't just be, you know, acting like an active app, a foreground app the entire time. Otherwise, your phone is just going to consider it an app, and that's bad for your battery. Do you think that that constraint is the correct way to treat widgets, or is this just the first in a series of upgrades to the widget system on iOS that eventually will make it look more like the way Android treats them?
I think this is just the first step that we're seeing here, because widgets by themselves are just so new to the platform that people will take a lot of time to get accustomed to them, because they just haven't been there before. So I think what Apple is doing in that context is really smart, because they're not going overboard in terms of letting developers build out these widgets. So by putting more restrictions now, I think it allows them to have more say in what widgets are actually able to do. And yeah, that's a good point about battery optimization, because that is a big issue on Android when you have these widgets that somehow seem haphazard, and there's no set of limit, and there's not really a whole lot of limitations or guidelines around them. So I think this kind of structured way is better for now. But then again, this is the first implementation of it, so we'll see how it goes from there. But for now, this is a good point.
Yeah, even in the static nature, like just being able to look at my home screen and not have to open an application to see like what's on my reminders for the day or what the current weather is like, or a view of upcoming calendar appointments. Like even that is such a basic thing, but it adds a whole nother layer of glanceability that just didn't exist before. And, you know, I really do hope, like Harish said, that this is something they expand upon with more interactability. But even with the static way, it still adds a lot more that you can do and understand with your phone than without having to open up an app and just look at your home screen and get that information quickly and move on with your day.
Okay, so I want to move past the widgets and the app drawer. Those are prosaic. I feel like they have been a long time coming. They will change the way people use their iPhone, but I don't know. For all intents and purposes, the fact that Apple still treats apps like they have to flow in from the top left, you can't put your widgets anywhere on the screen, I find that to be so frustrating. I do think that Apple just needs to get out of its own head and just trust users to put their app icons wherever the hell they want, and now their widgets wherever the hell they want, especially given the fact that the iPhone 10 or whatever, 11 Pro Max is massive, and being forced to fill up your home screen just so that you could put a widget near the bottom is insane to me, but I digress. Let's go over to picture in picture. That's new on iOS. It was on iPad, I believe, but you can now have picture in picture apps overlaid on top of existing ones on iOS 14. That's great. YouTube probably won't support it because Google's going to Google, which is hilarious. But I want to talk about these default apps, because this is just insane to me that Apple has taken this long and that the first implementation of it only supports mail apps and so hang on, what is it? Mail apps and
browsers.
Right. Okay. So first of all, every browser on iOS has to be a variant of Safari. You can't have your own browser engine for security reasons. So it's all just kind of, you know, a variant of the same thing. But beyond that, Harish, what's your impression of Apple finally allowing default apps and how that's going to change the way that people use their phones?
This is a big deal, and I don't really understand why it took them so long, given that most browsers, like you pointed out, are built on Safari. So they could have implemented this change ages ago. There's nothing preventing them from allowing Chrome to be the default browser. So I don't really understand why they had to wait this long, but I'm glad that it's finally here. I think in broad strokes, there's a lot of stuff about iOS where it feels like it's finally about time that Apple did it. This is a big deal because now you just don't need to be limited to Safari. Even though you have Chrome installed on the iPhone, I always use Chrome whenever I'm on the iPhone SE. But when you're within an app and you click on a link, it goes to Safari. So now you can set Chrome as the default browser, and that is a big deal, particularly if you have all your passwords saved in Chrome, and if you're logged into the Google ecosystem but still prefer using iPhones, this makes a lot of difference.
Obviously, developers have to support this first, so we don't know what it's going to be like. We also, I found out this week that, you know, Apple is not saying these will be the only types of apps that are supported for this default feature, that eventually maybe we will get calendar apps and camera apps and all these other things. So that's great. You know, on the one hand, when I install a new third-party camera app, for instance, on my phone on Android, and then I double-press the power button to quickly open my camera app, the first thing that happens is it asks me to select a default. And a lot of times, if I don't realize that's going to happen, I'm waiting for my camera app to open and nothing happens, or I miss the shot because I have to, you know, poke at the always button or whatever. And it's really annoying. And Google, I feel like, has gone through a lot of iterations of like simplification of other features, but this default app system has actually gotten worse over the last couple of versions, because it now asks you whether you always want to set an app to default, and you have to go into the app settings. It's just a mess. Mm-hmm. And Joe, I want to know, like, this is not an easy solution. This is not an easy thing to solve. There's a reason Apple is probably, from a business perspective, kept this to itself, right? But also just from a usability perspective, it's pretty hard to implement, as we know from Android. But I wonder, like, what's the consequence of this change? You know, this is an Apple that is slowly realizing that it can't own it. It owns all the hardware, but from a software perspective, it just has to relent a little bit of control in order to give users what they want.
Yeah, there's no way to really play around with it yet, because, like you said, no developers have updated their apps to support this, so we don't really know what the, from a user side of things, what that's going to look like when you select a new default browser email app. And I think that's part of the reason, like you mentioned, the how unpleasant of an experience it can be on Android is part of the reason why I think it's taken Apple so long, is because everything they do with iOS, as frustrating as it can be at times, is their vision of making it as easy and seamless for the biggest amount of users that they can. It could be something similar to Android, where you open the app for the first time and you get that pop-up notification, or it could be something where, you know, once it detects you download a browser or an email app, you get a prompt from the App Store. I'm not sure how they're going to do it, but I think it's just was something that was bound to come, especially with this update copying the widgets in the app drawer, where we've complained about this. Our grievances with iOS for years, and Apple has definitely heard those complaints. And I think it's just them slowly trying to test the waters and see how they can integrate these features and how they can make it better. With even something as small as like picture in picture, it's such a basic feature, but They added the things where you can pinch to zoom to make it smaller or bigger. You can quickly tuck it to the side so you get your audio playing, but you can bring out the video player again whenever you want to. I'm sure, however, the user prompt is to do the defaults will come with a lot of thought from software engineers and how Apple can make this as friendly to users as possible. But it's just one of those things that had to happen with Apple realizing that people want more ways to use their phone and more ways to customize it and make it their own. And I think iOS 14, given all the big changes that we got, it was the perfect time to kind of test the waters and see how this is going to go over with users.
I want to keep going through these features. The Translate app that's built in, shrug, like it is what it is. We'll see. I'm sure it'll be great and you know, helpful, but it's nothing that we don't already have on Android. You know, welcome to the club, I guess. App Clips, though, I think is fascinating because a lot of the rhetoric that I've seen about it has been, oh, this is just Android's instant apps, where, you know, you get a payload of a partial app that you can then use as a call to action to either, you know, exit it completely and there's nothing remaining on your phone, or you upgrade and download the full app on your through the Play Store. This is that, but I don't think App Clips were really designed as a way to get you to download the full app. I think this is really a way for you to perform an action quickly and then go back to your life without committing to downloading an app or say, entering your username and password or credit card number or whatever. And I find the way that Apple has marketed this idea of App Clips, you go up to an NFC tag on a parking meter, for instance, you tap your phone, Apple Pay then detects that you want to pay for this parking spot. You automatically pay for it by authenticating yourself and you move on. If you don't ever have to download that app, that's all the better because, hey, you're in a rental car, you're in a new city, you won't need to use this app again, blah, blah, blah. I think the idea behind this is super sound, and it's actually pointing to a missed opportunity by Google in when they rolled out App Clips or Instant Apps a few years ago. They didn't sort of surround it with all of these quick features and these quick usability improvements that Apple is highlighting here with this kind of short, app payload that is, under 10 megabytes. Harish, what's your take on App Clips?
I think this is a smart move again. Google did it first, but then it didn't really capitalize on that idea. I don't think I ever saw an instance where I was able to use that Google Play Instant, those instant apps. There just wasn't any, nothing showed up here. But I think the way they're highlighting, Apple is highlighting here is that you perform these quick actions and then just move on with your day. I think that's a very elegant solution for what that feature is meant to be. And just given the fact that Apple is good at getting developers on board and making sure that they enable these features and making sure that they actually end up working well on iOS and that a lot of customers actually get to use it, I think App Clips is actually going to be much more usable than instant apps ever were.
Yeah, I mean, I think I played with one or two instant apps when they first came out to test it out for an article I was writing, but ever since then, they've just kind of disappeared from memory, and I've never seen them surface on the Play Store. You don't really see developers or the Google Play Store really pushing them, and I've never thought of an instance where it would be genuinely useful to have an instant app, but in 10 minutes when Apple talked about App Clips during WWDC, it was instantly apparent of how this can be useful, how it can be implemented by developers, and it just seems like they have a better understanding of how to use this. And I hope Google kind of copies this idea and migrates Google Play Instant, if they still want to support that, to function more in the way that App Clips is going to.
Yeah, if you go to the developer site that highlights Google App Instant, which is, Google Instant Apps with a worse name, you can tell that this is really just a way to upsell your product, right? This is a way of getting users to engage with a particular piece of software so that in the hopes of downloading the full version, not so that you can perform a feature or a function quickly and then get out of it. And I think that if Google had sort of envisioned this feature with the idea of just encompassing Google Play Instant experiences as a standalone opportunity for users rather than just as a way for developers to push upgrades, I think it would have been much more successful. And the same with games, right? Like the developer site highlights the fact that you can download a portion of a game, essentially a game demo, and then get users to upgrade to those game demos or to those full versions. And the one highlight here is Candy Crush Saga, you know, like download a couple of levels of Candy Crush Saga without having to commit to the full game. And then by the time that they're addicted to it, they're going to want to upgrade to the full game and maybe spend some money. So, you know, obviously it's good that developers have other ways of getting higher engagement in their apps, earning more money. But I think instant apps have been a failure largely on Android. So, and I just think it's a huge, huge missed opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So last but not least, we won't go through the new Siri stuff because I don't trust Apple as far as I can throw it in regards to Siri. You know, whatever they say about the new design, whether it has 20 times the number of, pieces of information or 200 times, 2000 times, it's never going to be as good as Google Assistant. So we'll let the final version speak for itself. But I do want to talk about this sort of app permissions thing, the way that there's essentially a nutritional value that Apple is assigning to apps in terms of their privacy, and how they're going to have what is essentially a screen associated with every app on the App Store that will tell users what they are, what permissions the app requires, and how they're using those permissions to track you. This is something that Google has done a really good job with over the last few Android versions. It is very apparent that Google cares a lot about privacy now. I mean, it may be not always, but in the last few versions, this has become extremely heavily emphasized. Single use permissions, for instance, are coming in Android 11. Much more granular control over those permissions as well. If you don't use an app for a long time, the permissions, especially around location, are revoked automatically. So you don't have to worry that an app is going to track your location indefinitely. But Harish, when you look at this new sort of, you know, nutrition screen, what do you think? And is it something that Android should take wholesale?
Yeah, I definitely want Google to implement a version of this in Android 12, because I really like the fact that Android 11 got one-time permissions, and that is a huge deal for privacy. That was a long time coming too. But the issue with Google is that even though Google implements it, it may not trickle down to all these other manufacturers for several versions after that. So most of the time, Chinese brands do their own thing when it comes to privacy and security settings, and they don't necessarily take what Google has integrated into Android and sell that. So even if Google were to take this feature wholesale, we're not going to see that in, say, MIUI or EMUI. Well, not EMUI, but or ColorOS or any of the other Chinese skins. And that is the problem here. I feel that Google should take the feature, but only if it is baked into Android the way digital well-being is, or if they enforce every manufacturer to include it.
And it's probably not going to happen.
No.
Well, this is something, though, that they could probably just do for a Play Store update, right? Because the way Apple's doing this is just like an app privacy page when you're on the App Store to see before you download an app, you know, what permissions it's going to take. And the Google Play Store has something similar, but it requires digging into like the nitty-gritty app details and then finding another small permissions link. And it's not presented well, but you can still, after a lot of digging, find the permissions an app is going to use before you download it. So I think that the information is there, but just the way that Google currently presents it to users is nowhere near as apparent or user-friendly as the way that Apple's showing with iOS 14.
Yeah, I think the word is elegant, right? Like, there's a lot of things that Android does very well, and I think, you know, you would say that the last few versions of Android have been a lot more elegant than they were previously. But this stuff just feels deliberate. It feels like it's understanding how users are engaging with the platform, and that, you know, largely it's trying to hold developers to account. So if an app, for instance, is using your microphone or camera, there's now an indicator even when the app is not open, it's not in the foreground. These app privacy pages are going to be part of the app review process. So, you know, it's going to be a lot harder for apps to slide into the app store with these, you know, underhanded intentions, I guess. And as a result, it just reinforces this idea that the app store is the place that developers want to go. And it, you know, we talked about this last week around the issue with Hey, the email app that was originally denied access to the app store because of a contravention of some of the app store guidelines. That was resolved. Hey is now in the app store. It is receiving updates, and it's all good. But it does speak to the fact that developers are going to fight to get into the app store because that's where they get their growth. That's where they can earn the most money. And I think as much as Google has done to improve the experience of apps on Android, it just is not, it doesn't have the same attention. It, you know, you're not hearing about developers clamoring to get access to the same features or the newest features that Android is implementing because it still has to support all of these legacy versions. I think Slack, for instance, just dropped support for Android 5 Lollipop this week, which means that it's still supporting Android 6 through 10 right now, which is an insane number of legacy APIs to have to support. And, you know, Harish, this is just something that I know I've spoken to a lot of app developers who have to sustain or maintain Android apps, and they're not super happy about this.
I think this is the core of what makes iOS stand out. Sure, Apple doesn't really introduce features early or on at the same level as Google, but when it does roll out a feature, it makes sure that it is polished and that feature is something that customers actually care about and want to use. I think that's the difference between iOS and Google now, and Android now, because on a broad level, both operating systems are close in terms of the feature set. But when you talk about the ease of use and how consistent it is across iPhones, even if you look at older iPhones, I think that is why a lot of people like to use iOS, because it's just that familiarity. And you don't get that with Android. And that is one of the reasons why I like Android, because I'm now using a phone on OxygenOS and then I'll switch to MIUI. And those are two fundamentally different user interfaces. So I think that that customization is what makes Android great. But I would like to see some base features that are standard across the platform. I think that would make it easier for Google and developers.
Where that's kind of like the fundamental issue that we've had between the two is, you know, Android is without a doubt more fun to use. It's more customizable. You can really make it feel like your own phone. But then you have situations where developers, they have to support these legacy operating systems. They have to, you know, spend those resources to do that. They can't always, you know, readily implement new features that Google's adding with every new Android version. But then you get the opposite on iOS, where it's not as customizable. You can't do quite as much with it. But then you see that iOS 14 is getting rolled out to the iPhone 6S, which came out almost 5 years ago, yeah. Which there's a lot less overhead for these developers to worry about supporting old iOS versions, because all the old phones are running the new operating system. So it just makes it that much easier to adopt these features and make the experience that much more cohesive across the board.
So let's round out this conversation by talking a little bit about iOS 14 versus Android 11. I know that, you know, Android 11 has had a bit of a head start. It's been available as a developer preview for a few months. The first beta came out in mid-June. I've been using it on my phone as a daily driver. It's pretty buggy, but it does the job. I do think that one thing we didn't talk about on iOS, and nobody's really talked about on iOS, is notifications and how Apple really didn't touch notifications in iOS 14 and how Google just keeps improving notifications. It keeps making that experience where you basically spend so much of my day in my notification shade just that much better by adding a dedicated conversations area. The fact that like all of my messages now look the same. So a message from WhatsApp and Telegram and a text message, they all appear in that notification conversations view as, you know, essentially the same thing. You can inline reply, you can do smart replies. It just feels cohesive in a way that notifications on iOS never have. And as, you know, if you use your phone as a communications tool, Android still has that massive advantage. And I want to know from your perspective, what are other advantages that Android still has going into iOS or iPhone Android 11 versus all of these new features in iOS 14?
I think notifications are probably one of the biggest ones. I really like what we touched on earlier with how Google's been laser focused on the way permissions are handled. Security is obviously something that Apple takes very seriously, and there are good permission controls in iOS 14, but I still think Google has the upper hand with how they're presented. The new tools where you have to be a lot more deliberate about always giving an app access to certain features. And like I said, like what you talked about, notifications is still the biggest thing. It's taken me some time to get used to the way the conversation notifications are presented, but compared to just a endless sea of blocks of notifications with no true organization on iOS 14, it makes it a lot more difficult to keep up with emails, Slack notifications, and it's not an area Apple has really given a lot of attention to, but I think that's one of those things, again, where it's such a fundamental part of the operating system that for big changes to come to it, it's going to take a lot of time, a lot of focus groups and testing to make sure that when they implement a feature, it's going to work for everyone. Yeah, I think for me, it's the notifications is the biggest thing, and just that the way Google has been so hammered on permissions, which has been refreshing to see from a company that isn't necessarily seen in the same privacy light the way that Apple is by people.
Yeah, I like that Google is rolling out a few select features, but making sure that they're polished and work out of the gate, rather than just throwing like 20 different features and seeing what works and then just getting rid of those that don't. That conversation view actually makes a lot of difference. It doesn't feel like a major change. It's just pushing notifications to the top, but it makes a huge difference when you're pulling down that shade and you get like a dozen notifications. It was always hard to pick out the conversations in that, but now that they're highlighted at the top, that just makes it that much easier to get a hold of whoever contacted you. So that's one of the best features in Android 11 for me. And I also like the new power button menu. Just the fact that you can just press that power button and access all your smart home stuff, that just makes it that much easier to control lights and other stuff around the house.
Yeah, I've been using that quite a bit. I actually forgot my wallet yesterday when I went out to the grocery store and then realized that I had my credit card, my Google Pay card just available there. And it was one of those things where like, it's just a nice reminder that everything is now in one place. It might get really busy once developers start tweaking it. I know that Google's given a lot of leeway to developers in how they can access that power menu, but we'll see if it gets abused. I hope it doesn't, or at least that there's enough control, user control, that we can prevent it from getting abused. But we'll have to see in later versions. All right, I want to, before we move over to this OnePlus stuff, I do want to talk quickly about this transition from Intel to Apple Silicon / ARM. You know, Google's been rumored to be working on its own in-house silicon for a long time. It's experimented a little bit with it in the Pixel 2 and 3. And now, I mean, I guess the 4 has that, the Titan chip as well. But Harish, this is an Apple that's sort of working its way through another silicon transition. It went from PowerPC to Intel back in 2006. It took a couple of years. This one is expected to take the same amount of time. But it's a very different Apple. It's a very different set of complexities. And yet it feels like this is the only way forward given Intel's very, very slow move to smaller manufacturing nodes. It's struggled to hit 10 nanometers. 7 nanometers is nowhere to be found. And Apple's already on 7. It's heading to 5 relatively soon. Its chips are just better in so many ways. What is your take just from a, you know, we cover Qualcomm, we cover MediaTek, we cover all of these companies that put together chips based on the ARM instruction set that then sell these chips to manufacturers. But this is Apple totally controlling the stack. So what's your take on what that process is going to look like?
It's a huge deal because now they own the stack on all of their hardware. They've already had that with the iPhone and iPad with the A13 Bionic and the A12Z. And now they get to exert that same level of control on the Mac as well. And that is a fundamental shift because, as we've already seen, what that enables them to do is bring iPhone and iPad apps over to the Mac. And that is a big deal because Mac apps in the last 2-3 years have generally been abandoned because there was nothing interesting there. But now the ability to just use your iPad apps natively is going to be a huge deal for a lot of people. And it's going to enable them to deliver much better battery life. One of the things that Apple does really well, better than anybody else in the industry, is eke out these performance per watt figures. Just in terms of, just by its ability to control the whole stack, it's able to just deliver that much better efficiency figures. And we're going to start seeing that with the Mac as well. I think Intel was also to blame for this because Intel just couldn't get that 10 nanometer transition done. They were meant to do it back in 2015. Skylake just was not what Intel promised Apple. And I was reading an interview by Intel's former chief engineer, and he said that Skylake was the blame because Apple had so many issues with that platform, and they used that platform for like 2 or 3 generations of MacBooks. And when you have that many issues with the platform, you look to build your own solution. And they already had that with the A13, well, with their A series on the iPhone. So now I think ARM cores are at a point where Apple is able to say, okay, we're able to deliver the same level of performance as the x86 stuff from Intel. So I think it will be a very interesting transition period because on stage they demoed Adobe apps and Microsoft Office working out of the box. And that is a big deal because a lot of MacBook consumers are these pro users that want these video editing and photo editing tools to be available out of the box and work well. So it is a big deal that they're able to get developers on board and get those working out of the box. Yeah, that transition is going to take a year or two because it is a brand new platform. But Apple has shown that it can make tools that can smooth that transition over. And just the sheer fact that MacBooks will now be able to run iPad and iOS and iPhone apps is just like a crazy huge deal.
So, Joe, if you had the option later this year of buying a A-series or A-series powered MacBook Pro over an Intel powered one, would you make that choice knowing that you would probably be hampered at least in the initial few months by, you know, slow apps, app incompatibility, relying on you know, Rosetta for emulation and virtualization, or is that something you would jump into, you know, hands first?
I'd maybe hold off and wait just to see how the transition goes. Apple has been very upfront about Rosetta 2 easing this transition a bit, where you'll be able to run x86 or Intel-based apps on a A-series MacBook and supposedly have excellent performance. I mean, they ran Tomb Raider through that with meh graphics, but it was functional. Garbage.
Let's not pull any punches. It looked like crap. I mean, look, I don't think anybody expected it to be beautiful, you know, ray tracing 4K, but it was just ugly, and it was not. It was a bad demo because if you wanted to show it wasn't a thing that meant, hey, you should do this. Like, you should play a game using an emulation tool on the Mac. It was like, this is probably what you're going to experience, so I probably wouldn't go there. But that's just me.
Yeah, so I'm going to let that kind of settle in, give the transition some time. But personally, like for the past, I don't know, year and a half, 2 years or so, I've just used the late 2018 model of the iPad Pro as like my mobile workstation. I don't do a lot of video editing. I do raw photo editing, and it flies on that A chip in there. The touchscreen makes it easy for manipulated controls and getting really fine details of the Apple Pencil for getting out dust that never leaves phone displays when I try to photograph them. And I'm more interested in seeing, you know, now that we're going to have MacBooks and iPads running the same architecture and really not having much separating them to differentiate them from one or another on the core level, if this means we're going to see touchscreen MacBooks to some degree, or if Apple is still going to be very adamant about there being a clear distinction between this is an iPad and this is a MacBook and this is what their hardware looks like, or if a few years down the road we're going to see kind of a convergence where they meld together a bit and that line becomes a bit blurry, or if Apple doesn't want that to happen going down the road.
I think there will still be that distinction between the iPad Pro and the MacBook Air, because at least for the first generation or so, these ARM machines are going to be focused on the thin and light form factor. So we're not going to see the MacBook Pros powered by ARM chipsets anytime soon. Apple has come out and mentioned that they're going to use Intel for at least one more generation. So I think whatever is going to come out at the end of this year will still run x86. But I think what they're going to focus on initially will be that MacBook Air form factor. I think they're going to bring it closer to the iPad Pro, but the differentiation with the iPad is going to be the touchscreen, because otherwise, if a MacBook had a touchscreen, there's not going to be any difference between the two.
I want to bring this back to Android just as we close out this conversation, if only because, you know, there's been a lot of talk about, you know, Project Athena-based Chromebooks, all of them are Intel powered, and how Chrome has sort of vacillated over the years between sort of favoring x86 or ARM. A lot of times cheaper Chromebooks are ARM powered. You know, there's been a ton of like rock chip powered Chromebooks over the years that aren't very good. But I think what's weird is that the industry has settled, at least in 2019, 2020, on Intel as the main chip provider for relatively high performance Chromebooks. With Project Athena, we're seeing a lot of higher spec'd Chromebooks, especially that just speak to the fact that this is the direction that Google is going, if only because it does not seem to have a reliable source of ARM-based chips that are able to give Chromebooks enough power to, you know, to be in the same conversation as high performance Windows and Mac laptops. And I wonder what your thought is, Harish, on whether that will change anytime soon, or whether Apple is just in this really unique position to be able to say that their ARM-based chips are powerful enough to really push laptop performance to the point where there is no difference in performance, I guess, or experience between it and an Intel-based laptop, while also benefiting from better battery life and lower power output or heat output.
I think with Chromebooks, Google is finally realizing that it needs to have its own custom silicon for it to deliver the same level of performance across the platform. Because from what I understand of Chromebooks, the performance is going to vary significantly based on what sort of chipset is under the hood. So I think we're going to see more Google making more headway on that front. There's already this thing that Google is going to roll out its chipset on the Pixel next year. So I think they're going to scale that up for Chromebooks as well, because that is just going to be not that big a transition going from the power that a Pixel needs, of your phone needs, to a Chromebook. So if they can do a good job with that first chipset, I think they will be able to deliver better performance on Chromebooks. But I don't know. Google has generally shied away from doing its own hardware. It did custom silicon on the Pixel with the image chip and all that. But I feel like Google should get on that and get on it relatively soon, because then it would allow it to have more control over the hardware stack as well. And I think that would allow it to differentiate Pixels much more than what we have today.
And that's been rumored for years and years, but nothing yet. So we'll see. You know, that being said, you can still get a really good, relatively inexpensive Chromebook, Intel powered, with good battery life. Our own best Chromebooks roundup, you know, suggests the Asus Chromebook Flip C434. There are tons of great options out there, so you don't have to worry about it, at least right now. But it's been an hour. We've been kind of sitting on a little bit. Let's talk about this OnePlus Nord leak, you know, that you've had. Let's talk about the phone itself, what we know about it. We haven't really spoken about it much on this podcast, but we've been reporting on the site for a long time now. So Harish, you had an exclusive leak today that detailed the front-facing cameras on the OnePlus Nord. This is a inexpensive, or at least less expensive, phone from OnePlus that will be announced in July, on July 10th. It's going to be focused on the Indian market. And your leak says that the front-facing camera will be a dual module. It'll have a 32-megapixel primary and an 8-megapixel wide angle. Talk us through the idea behind this phone, why it's important to OnePlus and the market in general, and maybe why it won't really be a big deal for the North American market, at least at the beginning.
Yeah. So I'll give you some context about OnePlus in India, because India is the company's biggest market. I think in 2020, it accounts for over 40% of its global sales. And for the last 2 years, OnePlus did really well in India because it was able to leverage that premium branding very well. And it overtook Samsung, and it is now the leading premium phone manufacturer in India. Now, the premium segment in itself is tiny. I think it's like 2% of the overall market. So while OnePlus is the big fish in that pond, it's a relatively small pond. So a lot of the success that OnePlus saw in India over the years was because of its value-focused models. But in the last year, with the 7 Pro and the 7T, it shifted to a higher price point. And I think it's realizing now that it needed to deliver on that. It needed to have a phone in that value segment, that $300 to $400 price point, for it to maintain its growth and ensure that it's still like the leading brand in that segment. So I think that is the main idea behind the OnePlus Nord. I think they wanted to reevaluate their product category and decide that they needed to have some phone that was around $300 to $400, because the rest of their phones are costly now. I'll give you some insight into the OnePlus 8 Pro in India. I think in the US, it starts off at $900, but they launched the same thing in India for $725. Because if they would have launched it at 900, nobody would have bought the phone. So that goes to show just how thin margins OnePlus has in India, that it's willing to just effectively sell the phone at, say, near manufacturing cost just to maintain its market share. So that is the context behind the Nord. It needed to have a phone to take on Xiaomi and Realme and a lot of these other Chinese brands that are doing really well in that $300 segment. And OnePlus generally does a good job with its hardware, and we're seeing that with the Nord. It's meant to come with the Snapdragon 765, and yeah, that dual camera is particularly interesting because OnePlus really hasn't done anything with the front camera for the last 3 years. The 3T was when the 16MP front camera debuted, and they've changed the sensor a few times, but it's still the same resolution on the 8 Pro. And even on the 8 Pro, it doesn't feel that great. I didn't like using the selfie camera on that at all. So it's interesting that they're focusing on the front camera as being the differentiator, because again, OnePlus's entire market share in India is targeted at a younger audience, let's say 18 to 25 college going kids. And I think that is one of the main considerations behind switching to a 32 megapixel sensor and adding that second wide angle 8 megapixel sensor, because we haven't seen that second sensor on anything other than the Pixel 3 XL so far. So I think that is their reasoning behind the phone. And I think it should do well, because just based on the amount of interest we've had in this phone, a lot of people in India are very excited to get their hands on it.
I want to know what your take is on this separation of the core OnePlus development team that's putting, you know, its resources behind the OnePlus 8 series, the higher end phones, and what sounds like a brand new division headed up by Carl Pei, you know, the chief marketing officer, focusing on the budget segment, focusing on India and maybe sort of Eastern Europe and other developing markets where a cheaper phone is necessary to compete with Xiaomi and Oppo. What do you think the end goal is here? Is it just to create one of those sub-brands a la Realme, Redmi, or is there something different that OnePlus is going to be able to accomplish here?
I think OnePlus is realizing that it just cannot have a premium phone. It's a very interesting strategy that they had over the last 2 years. So in 2019, their entire focus was on the premium segment, whether that was with the phone with the 7 Pro or with the TV, which they launched in India last year. That TV was a premium TV that was positioned against Samsung and Sony. It cost like $1,500. Whereas in 2020, they're all of their focus is on the budget segment. Now they're going to introduce a $300 phone, and the TV is also going to start off at like $200, $250. So I think they're now going to position themselves in such a way that they're having one affordable line that makes their products accessible to a wider audience. And they're going to have a different series altogether that's positioned at the high-end segment. And I think that's a smart strategy, because it effectively allows them to battle on two fronts. And I think that is what they needed to do in 2020.
Joe, when you see a phone as well-specced as the OnePlus Nord, which is a terrible name, and you hear that it's not coming to North America, you know, you're in the US market, you understand how people tend to buy their phones. It's predominantly at carriers. Increasingly, it's on financing plans where you can essentially amortize the cost of a high-end phone over 24, 36 months to add, you know, 20, 30 bucks a month to your bill, as opposed to paying for it up front. That just isn't the case in most of the world. And I'm wondering whether you think there would be a market for a phone like the OnePlus Nord, given the fact that a lot of people are looking to it to compete with the Pixel 4a, which is $400. If this comes in at $299, $350, whatever, that's going to be a significantly better deal than the Pixel 4a, even if it doesn't come with all of the niceties that Google brings its phones. What do you think?
Yeah, I think there would definitely be a market and consumers that'd be interested in it. As someone that, you know, is heavily invested with a lot of these mid-range Android phones, with like what Motorola does, what Nokia does, if OnePlus brought this for $300-$400 with the spec loadout it has, there's no doubt it would be one of the better, if not the best, you know, phone in this price range you could buy. But it's been very apparent for last year and especially this year that OnePlus is very much so trying to shift towards that Samsung or the Apple level of premium high-end smartphone experiences. On the launch day for the OnePlus 8, if you looked at OnePlus's website, it was dominated by, you know, T-Mobile, Verizon. If you went to Verizon's website, there were big banners for the OnePlus 8 5G UW, whatever awful name they gave the carrier version of it. They're really pushing these partnerships with the carriers because they know that's how a lot of people in the US still buy their phones, even though that's not what me or Andrew or Ara or other people in the US on AC, we buy our phones unlocked probably, and that's what we're familiar with. But most regular general consumers are still very much in the mindset of you go to the carrier store, you get on a financing plan, and that's how you go about it. Even on OnePlus's own website, I was browsing through there the other day, and there was a little customer survey of what would be your thoughts if OnePlus did its own one smartphone upgrade program, and how many months would you like to pay off your phone? And they're trying to get themselves into the financing side of things. So for, I think, people like us that are really in tune with the mid-range or the mid-tier level of value flagships that are up and coming, OnePlus Nord would definitely be an interesting device. But for the main consumer base for OnePlus in the US is very much so carrier focused, and a phone like that wouldn't make as much sense the way a OnePlus 8 or an 8 Pro does right now.
Harish, when you look at the Indian market as it stands today, what's your impression of the impact OnePlus Nord would have given OnePlus's success, but also, you know, knowing that Realme, Redmi, and just, you know, budget phones from other companies in general. Samsung, the Galaxy A51 was the world's best-selling Android phone this year so far. But what's your take on how this would actually fare?
I think it has the potential to do really well. But then what we have to understand is that OnePlus is not a major player. I think OnePlus does a really good job dominating the mindshare, but it just does not have the market share as, say, Xiaomi, Vivo, Oppo, or any of the other major brands. So I think this allows them to break into that mainstream market a little bit more. And one of the reasons they're able to do that is just by selling the phone at near manufacturing value, because at $300, they're not going to make a lot of money off of this phone just by the fact that it has the 765 chipset. And I don't actually know why they have that in there, because there's no 5G in India. So it's purely for the fact that customers here expect either the 765 or the 865 in that price point. So they are not going to make a lot of money off of the phone, but I think this will give them that boost in market share that they've been lacking over the last 4 or 5 years that they've been selling phones in India. Because even though a lot of our readers know about the brand and it's now making its way into the general psyche, it just doesn't have that presence of any of the other major brands. Even in India, if you go to any major store, all of these other brands, say Samsung, Xiaomi, Oppo, and Vivo, are clearly highlighted. But OnePlus has traditionally been that online-only brand. So now it's trying to venture into the offline market a little bit more for visibility. So I think more than anything else, the Nord gives them that visibility and makes them break out into that mainstream segment a little bit more. And ironically, it's also one of the reasons why they won't be able to sell this phone in the US, because at $300, they're just not going to make any money in India. And they have the overhead of partnering with a carrier or team or selling it on Amazon and have to manage inventory. And they're generally not great with having a large inventory of phones. The way OnePlus has always worked is that they do small production runs and then have those units sent out. So that's why even if you've tried to buy a OnePlus phone in the past in the US direct from them, you wouldn't have seen it intermittently going out of stock on its store. So that's the reason. They're just not going to be able to sell that to customers at $300. And I guess that's a bad thing, because US customers are going to miss out on that.
So, I mean, there is no question that at $300, the margins are going to be just tiny, razor thin for OnePlus. But the company's had no issues in the past selling its phones in the US at a premium over India. You brought that up with the OnePlus 8 series as well. So if they do end up selling the Nord in the US unlocked, it may come in at $400 to compete with the Pixel 4a. Do you think that it's likely that it will be available in the unlocked sales channel at all in the US, or just won't hit the market, period?
I don't think so, because even if you look at last year, they didn't bring the 70 Pro over to the US, because I think they're being very strategic about what they launch in the US. If I had to guess, I think this nod that we're seeing is just the first in a series of affordable phones. And even if this doesn't make its way to the US, I think we'll see something later on down the line with the mid-cycle refresh that they do eventually in fall. I think that may come to the US because I think that would be a better strategy for them, because the OnePlus 8 series is just going on sale now. They've had issues with availability. So I think they would want to position that and just focus their attention on the OnePlus 8 series in the US for now, and then maybe introduce another model in the Nord series later on in the year.
Well, that is slightly disappointing, but you know, I guess not surprising. So just for my edification, how big is the phone? Is it OnePlus X size, or is it larger than that?
No, they're going to call it a compact phone, so it's going to be massive.
R.I.P. Oh man, yeah. I was cleaning out my phone drawer the other day, and I found the OnePlus X, and it's just tiny. It's just this like little bit. It's really lovely. I've been really enjoying using the iPhone SE for that very reason. It just kind of like it disappears in your pocket. It's very refreshing.
Yeah, I loved using that phone. I think they were ahead of the game with that. I think if they just gave that phone some more time, it would have flourished into its own series or whatever. Because I think at the time, that was not the correct phone to launch. But if they would have introduced it a few years down the line, it would have sold in crazy numbers.
Yeah, interesting. Well, you know, I guess we will just have to wait until July 10th for that announcement. The same time, OnePlus will be announcing a new set of TVs. Tell us quickly about what to expect with that.
So I talked to Pete about this. Pete Lau is the CEO.
Yep.
Yeah. And it's interesting that they're focusing on design being one of the key differentiators with this, because that was the main selling point of their premium TV as well. So even though the upcoming TVs are going to be focused on the budget segment, they're not going to compromise on that design front. So it'll have that carbon fiber texture at the back, and it's going to have a bezel-less screen and a panel with a high color gamut. So I think they're not going to compromise on a few features just because they're selling a budget TV, but they're still going to offer that same premium-like experience. So I think that actually makes sense, because whatever we have now in the budget segment, say the Xiaomi TV, and now Realme also rolled out a TV earlier this year, they're not that great to look at. So I think if they're able to roll out a TV at the same price point and take a cut on the margins initially, they have a chance to build decent market share.
Yeah, that is wild.
Yeah.
That it's just like a whole segment of a whole segment that does not exist outside of India. All of these companies make TVs. Are they unique? Like, do these companies manufacture them themselves, or is it more like an ODM situation where they hire the same manufacturer and just rebrand them?
Xiaomi uses Dixon. That's one of the ODM partners for it. But I don't know what Realme is using. Based on BBK scale, I would venture that they're going with somebody else to manufacture panels. And I think that is also one of the reasons OnePlus is getting into the budget TV game, because I think it just makes sense for them to have two or three brands positioning their products in that segment.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, if you're interested in reading the full interview with Pete Lau, go to androidcentral.com. Harish also has that very cool exclusive on the OnePlus Nord, and we will learn much more about that phone in the coming weeks. Harish, you also have another podcast that you co-host every week. Tell us a bit about that before we end.
Yeah, so I got together with a few friends, not colleagues, in India, and we wanted to do a candid podcast because the podcast scene in general is not that huge in India. So we just wanted a platform where we can just talk about tech and then just rant about a few things that we see in the Indian market. So it's called the Untitled Gadget Podcast. And we just talk about whatever launches in India and some of the unique things that are in the market, because we get so many phones in India. Right now in the US, it's off season, but I think we had two phones launching last week, two phones this week, and a TV next week, and two phones the week after that. So it's just a relentless launch cycle. And we just wanted a platform where we can just talk about that in a little bit more detail.
I love it. I've heard a couple of episodes and you're very funny. I appreciate it. It's also extremely informative as somebody who does not, it's such a different market, right? It's such a crazy competitive situation in India compared to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
And as we've said many times, like the smartphone industry is just so much more interesting outside of North America. And we don't do a great job covering it on the podcast just for our audience reasons. But I highly recommend subscribing to the Untitled Gadget podcast. All right, Harish, where can people find you if they want to learn more about what you do?
I'm on Twitter at Chunky Nerd, and Instagram is Harish LJ.
And you post very pretty pictures on on Instagram as well. And Joe Maring, what about you? Where can people find out more about what you do?
I don't have a fun, fancy podcast host. But
Maring,
either
one. I keep screwing up your name. I'm terrible.
I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Joe Maring or Joe Maring 1, however you want to think about it in your head when you type it. I don't do a lot on Instagram other than Instagram stories of my dog, and that's about it.
Damon, though, is the best dog. I highly recommend he is. Following you just for those photos. And as somebody who has a name that is constantly screwed up, people say batter instead of baiter all the time to me. It's been happening my entire life. I'm so sorry. So yeah, go check out Joe's work on Android Central as well as Harish's. You can find me at Journey Dan and all of our work at AC. We will be back next week with a brand new episode, and it won't be nearly as Apple focused. So if you weren't really that interested in today's conversation, I hope it was edifying, because it gives you this perspective of the other side. It gives you some context as to what Google really needs to focus on in future versions of Android. But if you have thoughts on iOS 14, send us an email, podcast@androidcentral.com. We love, love, love hearing from you. That is it for this week's show. We will be back next week. My name is Daniel Bader. Bye-bye.
See ya.
Bye.